Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hello, Chicago!
From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week we do a classic album dissection on Joni Mitchell's masterpiece, Blue.
We'll discuss Joni Mitchell's career, the context of Blue, and its lasting impact and importance. And we'll analyze a few of our favorite tracks.
We'll also hear from Joni Mitchell biographer David Yaffe and music critic Lindsay Zolads. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
Smash our empty glasses down. Let's have a round for these freaks and these.
I am on a lonely road and I am traveling, 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 looking for something. What can it be?
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And that's a little bit of the song All I Want by Joni Mitchell, the lead-off track from her 1971 album Blue. Even 47 years later, people are still talking about this record and influenced and moved by it, regarded as one of the greatest of all time, certainly one of Joni's greatest works. Unflinching honesty, poetic lyrics, those were elements in this record that inspired a range of artists. Tori Amos, Liz Phair, even Prince was singing Joni Mitchell's praises for years. Today, we're going to take a deep dive into Blue and discuss why it's a classic album and dissect some of the tracks, and we're later going to share our opinions on it.
Absolutely, Greg. Who is Joni Mitchell? Born 1943, Roberta Joan Anderson in rural Alberta, Canada. Was a creative kid, apparently, right from the start. Would later go on to art school, but it was not an easy upbringing. She contracted polio early on. It was that time, bedridden, when she learned how to play guitar and began to sing. She got pregnant when she was a poor folk singer, struggling to make her name in Toronto in the mid-60s, had a daughter that she gave up for adoption. It was only years later, in the mid-90s, when a tabloid outed that she'd had this child. They since reconciled. But what a thing to be exposed to the public. A series of toxic, sometimes chaotic, certainly romantic relationships that I think got undue attention often. And all through it, Joni is writing countless iconic songs in the folk pop tradition. From Both Sides Now.
I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow.
To Big Yellow Taxi.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? You paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Today we're going to zero in on what many people believe to be Mitchell's greatest album, Blue. We're going to start our conversation by speaking with David Yaffe, author of the biography Reckless Daughter, a portrait of Joni Mitchell. That book was released in 2017 and details Joni's life, career, and music. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
For the young'uns out there, David, who don't know, can you give us the capsule biography, this young woman from Canada, and how she set the world on fire, or started to, in the music world?
It's interesting because usually when someone is a writer, when someone is a musician, they have idols that they want to emulate. And that didn't happen with Joni, not really. She had people that she knew how to imitate, but she didn't idolize them. So she's an unusual case that she's a great artist who didn't have somebody that she tried to emulate first.
Do you think this is part of growing up sort of remotely?
Well, that's part of it. She did grow up in this place that Margaret Atwood described as a blank space on global culture.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very isolated. It was very remote. Her family didn't have money. She didn't travel, really. So she just had that open sky in her creativity. She didn't have exposure to much. But she said she didn't grow up playing air guitar in the mirror or anything like that. She thought of herself as a visual artist, but really on a practical level, she thought that she probably ended up working in the fashion industry and that this folk revival was a fad and it would go on for a few years and it would die out and then she would do something else.
He has heard her off to starboard in the breaking and the breathing of the water weeds while she was busy being free.
Something that set her off from the other children was when she got polio at age 10 and she was taken to this polio colony. And her father never visited. Her mother visited once with a mask on. 6 months go by, she gets her legs back. And suddenly she's no longer the first one picked for teams. You know, and she had thought of herself as an athlete. She kind of defined herself through that, you know, and suddenly her sense of identity was gone. And so she started to turn inward and she started to define herself as an artist, as a visual artist, the kid who could draw the best doghouse, that kind of thing.
Mm.
And all she really needed was just to go off in nature somewhere, go off in the woods, and be creative. And that was how she got through. And then she goes to art school. She doesn't have a scholarship. And so nobody's really treating her like she's special.
So this arty kid, it seems like almost a little daydreamy as a teenager, figures out how to play guitar and basically invents an entire new style with the open tunings. ...50 open tunings by the end of her career, or as her career is winding down. This incredible method of approaching this instrument with an immaculate voice to go with it. And then this incredible songwriting acumen on top of it, all apparently self-taught, right? I mean, what
completely.
Was...
Completely. And she didn't know that would happen.
And David, we mentioned it earlier, but she's in college at art school. She gets pregnant during her sophomore year. She gives the baby up for adoption. This affected her very deeply. Where is she mentally at this point, and how do you think it was reflected in her music?
That's right. And she's living in a very, very cheap rooming house. She's completely broke. I mean, she has the money that she's making from folk gigs, but then when she starts to show too much, she can't perform anymore. And so she's really, you know, like her neighbors are taking pity on her and giving her fruit and stuff like that. I mean, she's really, really broke. So she gives birth February 19th, 1965. It's one of those things where, like, it's a situation where someone is pent up and can't say what she's thinking and can't say what she's feeling and has to keep a big, big secret about the source of it all. And then it comes out in the sublimated way through these beautiful songs.
Child with a child pretending. Weary of lies you are sending home. So you sign all the papers in the family name. You're sad and you're sorry, but you're not ashamed. A little grief.
And so because she was hiding this shame, and because she had this grief of giving up her daughter, the first song that she ever writes is on the train. She's with the guy who got her pregnant, this guy named Brad McMath, who took off soon after. They go on this 14-hour train ride to Toronto. And so she hadn't written any songs. She was just doing traditional folk songs. She was singing the songs that Joan Baez and Judy Collins were singing. She was singing songs out of the child ballad book. You know, Nancy Whiskey.
Whiskey.
So she's on the train And she starts to write this beautiful song. It's called Day After Day. She never records it. But it you can hear it on YouTube. There's a demo of it.
Day after day, miles and miles of railroad track, night after night, harmon of the wheels.
Those kind of triadic folk chords that she got away from pretty quickly. It's about a damsel in distress who's waiting for a hero on a horse to come and save her, but she doesn't think that's going to happen, so that's the sadness of the song. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful song, and it's amazing. It's her first try, and she didn't think it was good enough to record, probably because it was too derivative, but very impressive for her first try.
Mm-hmm.
And, and the second song she writes becomes a minor hit on the country charts, and that song is Urge for Going.
Yeah,
which was
her second song.
That's her second song.
When the sun turns traitor golden, all the trees are shivering in a naked row, I get the urge for going, but I never seem to go.
So let's fast forward a bit. Joni goes on to record her first three albums by 1970. She's won a Grammy, garnered a large fan base, found commercial success, and this is right before she starts recording her fourth album, the record we're focusing on today, Blue. How did she handle this, since stardom and being famous wasn't really something she was looking for?
You go into it, you hope that you make it, and then there's no exit strategy. That's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that always the case?
Right. Right.
In Joni's case, because her work was so personal, she didn't have a way of creating the kind of barrier that probably you would need to have a healthy attitude toward it. I mean, when you think about, for example, the way Dylan was in 66, when he was so vulnerable, and you could see why he couldn't handle it and why he had to go off the road for 8 years. And then you see him after that, and you see that he kind of creates this persona that distances himself a little bit and allows him to function in a way, because there's a barrier between him and the audience. And I feel like Joni never really got that. Joni was always herself.
Now me, I play for fortunes and those velvet curtain calls.
So that work is intimate in every way. And so I think that when she felt vulnerable, it brought on something that she thought of as, like, she said, well, people in the West might call it a nervous breakdown, but I thought of it more as a shamanistic breakthrough. A shamanistic breakthrough. That's how she thought of it. And so she wanted to, you know, she announced her retirement in 1970, and she went to live in a cave in Greece.
Mm-hmm. Was it literally a cave? Did you get to the bottom of that? In
yes.
Greece, is she literally living in a rock hole? Mm.
Yes, yes. She was with this girl named Joellen, and she was living. Yeah, it was a fashionable place to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of hippies were hanging out there. and then, of course, it was there that this girl, Joellen Lapidus, designed a dulcimer for her that she ended up recording with on Blue. She did Case of You on that dulcimer, right?
Yeah, right.
California also. She was engaged to Graham Nash. They were living together in Laurel Canyon in that house on Lookout Mountain, and which I've been in the house. It's a pretty modest house for rock stars to live in. It looked like a place that two graduate students would be sharing, really. She was making money, but I just don't think she knew what that was or how to deal with it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause she was just thinking about, you know, being creative and doing what she wanted and dropping acid when she wanted to and whatever.
Well, there's that fascinating interview she gives to Cameron Crowe about that, mm-hmm. that point in her life. I came to a turning point, the terrible opportunity people are given in their lives, the day they discover to the tips of their toes that they're a-holes. Mm-hmm. 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 What is she talking about?
She said that she could look at people and read into them and read into their souls. And it was so overwhelming to her that she would be at the supermarket and she would see somebody's soul and she would cry. And that the very thing that she was doing in Blue, which terrified some people and which besotted others, was that she was doing that with her listeners.
Mm-hmm. Right, because that quote is in relation to her being where she's at when she's writing and recording Blue.
Yes, but I think when you hear, for example, like the title track of Blue... And so beautifully distilled about this melancholy that she's describing. And the fact that she's using a color to describe it is so important because she used synesthesia. She thought like a visual artist.
Yeah.
You know, her parents, her father was colorblind. Her mother was also, she thought, colorblind. Whereas she was color acute. So part of it was responding to her parents. And saying, I can see things that you can't see. You didn't know what you were doing when you were raising me because you couldn't see. I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so when she says blue, it means a lot. It's an emotion. It's a color. It's tied to the blues. You know, she loves kind of blue. That was probably in the mix there.
Well, it was very poetic writing. She wasn't she wasn't being super literal. And I think that's part of the charm of the record is that people want to read all this stuff into it, but there's also a universal quality to it that allows anybody to see themselves in it if they want to.
I mean, that's true, and I call it the Joni Mitchell effect because she's hiding in plain sight.
We're talking with David Yaffe, author of Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. You know, this very 1970 habit of the music world in particular, but life in general, of framing a woman's talents and success and career with the men in her life. So as a biographer, you're telling the story of making Blue, writing Blue, recording Blue, and you can't ignore, you know, there's the Graham Nash relationship has unraveled, the time in Crete, living in the cave in Greece, there's a relationship with a waiter, and then James Taylor's in the wings and this romance.
There was a Peace Corps activist who was a cook named Carrie Raddatz. Carrie's the song, and then Leonard Cohen is in there too because A Case of You is really... about Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to the extent that any song is about anybody.
Well, I think it was also, I think just for additional context here, I mean, just to add to that, is that the way the record was perceived around that time, Rolling Stone did a whole section about who Joni Mitchell had slept with around the time that this record came out, which to me kind of like, okay, that is a typical male response to a record by a woman to frame it in terms of who she'd slept with. As
especially
opposed
with
to,
that generation, that generation of men. And that, I guess what I would say is that her experiences are hers just in the same way that Bob Dylan's experiences are his, or that Leonard Cohen's experiences are his, or John Lennon's, or whoever else you want to think of as being in the peer group of Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon. They write about their life. They write about their loves. They write about their sex life. They write about what they do. And it's their prerogative to do it as artists, and nobody's going to question it. And just as nobody should question it if you're Joni Mitchell or anybody else. Right, everybody's life is up for grabs when you're an artist. So she's an artist. But I also think that the experiences are less important than the fact that they happen to Joni Mitchell, and that Joni Mitchell then has this way of articulating it. She has this way of interpreting it. She has this way of expressing her reaction to things that happen to her. And so it's not very remarkable to, you know, have a love life, have breakups. Yes, some of those people that she was intimate with were famous, but that's pretty typical too if you think about it, because people, they often hook up with people that they're in the same field with.
What you're saying though, if you remove all of that context of who it was specifically that she may or may not have been writing about, it's still a masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece, but in fact, I think that if you're to take it for what it should be, then it is about intimacy. I mean, that's part of the story. It is about relationships. I think it's artificial to remove it from its intimate content because that's the point.
I want to talk to you. I want to shampoo you. I want to renew you again and again. Applause, applause. Life is a pause when I think of your kisses. My mind seesaws.
You know, David, you used the word intimacy, and I think it's a fascinating one. And my rock critic hero, Lester Bangs, said of Blue that it's a record that's too intimate. I almost feel like a voyeur as a man listening to Blue. It makes me uncomfortable. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, I think she wanted, because she was feeling uncomfortable herself. And so I think that's... That's the effect that she wanted. I mean, I think she wanted to confront people, although she did so in dulcet tones, but she did. I mean, the last time I saw Richard is a confrontation,
mm-hmm.
for sure. You know, all romantics meet the same fate someday. That is meant to make people uncomfortable, although, of course, it's with this, you know, beautiful voice and these beautiful climbing piano chords and so on.
I'm gonna blow this damn candle out. I don't want nobody coming over to my table. I've got nothing to talk to anybody about. All good dreamers pass this way someday. Hiding behind bottles in dark cafes.
It's a combination of the lyric writing, the melody writing, the chords, the rhythms, with these truths, these intimate and often uncomfortable truths. To be fair about this record, by the way, and I think I said this in the book, that Blue was maybe a 60% moping record and a 40% party record.
Yeah.
Because some of those songs are actually joyous. And when people talk about Blue, they think about all this grim stuff. But you have Carrie, which is a playful song, and it's a song you can dance to.
Oh, Carrie, get out your cage.
Carrie, get out your cage.
California is kind of hopeful,
California,
too.
California is kind of sweet.
California, coming home. I'm going to see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset pig. California, I'm coming home.
It's interesting because, like, you know, she wasn't like Janis Joplin. I mean, Janis Joplin had this kind of raw reality that she was taking it to. And it was something that, you know, led to later Patti Smith and whoever else you want to say, Lucinda Williams, Liz Phair. I mean, a certain kind of aggressive quality that Joni herself would kind of have in a later incarnation of her life. But on Blue, everything is so euphonious. Even when she's talking about the darkest thing, I mean, Blue is this beautiful, beautiful song. Like, while it's about losing yourself and to something that could be, you know, the heroin that James Taylor was hooked on. It could be just going to the darkest, darkest place of trying to hide in this cloud of melancholy.
Well, there's so many sinking, now you gotta keep thinking you can make it through these waves. Acid, booze, and ass, needles, guns, and grass, lots of laughs.
The album... especially if you go to the bluest songs on Blue, like Blue, like the last time I saw Richard, like A Case of You, it's just, I mean, this is a word that's used about it a lot, but it's just so honest. But what's remarkable is that a lot of things can be honest. Something can be honest and also not be good, right?
Sure.
Blue is unflinchingly honest, and it's a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and maybe that makes people uncomfortable.
It's confusing to men because I think the emotions that she's talking about, a lot of guys really are uncomfortable dealing with those. Let's forget not just Joni Mitchell, but just talking to women in this way in general mm-hmm. for a lot of men is very difficult. And I know a lot of women who really relate to this record because mm-hmm. she's expressing what they would like to say or are feeling but can't articulate necessarily.
Yes,
so it's an interesting split the way – it's interesting that a lot of male critics reviewed this record at the time. But since then, we've seen a lot of women chiming in on the record, you know, as their voices become more heard in our media. And I think they're the ones that are really championing this record in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah, and I mean, listening to it in 2018, or listening to it just, you know, anytime in the new millennium, or listening to it in the 90s.
Yeah,
it's a different experience than listening to it in 1971, and also about like why it wasn't that well received when it came out. It was not an instant big seller when it came out. It took a long time to become her biggest seller. And a lot of that was like in the 90s.
Yeah.
Really. And when the whole sensibility changed, and when you could be a different kind of a woman. I think like Patti Smith like really shook a lot of people up and sort of moved the needle on all the ways that you could express yourself as a woman.
We've been talking with David Yaffe, author of the biography Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. David, thanks for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for such a stimulating conversation.
After a short break, we'll continue our discussion of Joni Mitchell's Blue by talking to music critic Lindsay Zolads about blues' impact. Later, we'll share some of our favorite tracks from that record. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. We don't.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
All good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And this week we're talking about the 1971 album Blue by Joni Mitchell. Now, earlier in the show, we discussed the context of the record and some of the tracks. And now we want to explore the album's influence, the lasting impact and legacy of Joni Mitchell today. Here to talk about it is music writer and critic for The Ringer, Lindsay Zolads. Lindsay, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
You wrote this brilliant piece, Fear of a Female Genius, about Joni Mitchell, and we thought you'd be a perfect voice to bring in to this conversation as we look at the legacy of Blue. I mean, first of all, that's a brilliant title and a brilliant phrase you use throughout the piece. Tell us what you're thinking of when you say there's a fear of Joni Mitchell's female genius.
Yeah, I think that there are just so few examples in pop culture of women who have lived and had careers and behaved like men who we call geniuses. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of her music, but I am fascinated by the way that she's moved throughout the culture and at each stop and each decade and era kind of shown us what the resistance was to a woman living and working as freely as she did.
Uncompromising, brutal when someone, you know, mm-hmm. challenges her. She, you know, she takes no guff from nobody, never.
Yeah, absolutely. She was so impervious to the criticism. She didn't ever let it slow her down or change the way she was doing business or soften her in any way. And I just think she's so fascinating for that reason and for so many other reasons, too. Oh, star bright, you've got the loving that I like, all right. Turn this crazy bird around, I shouldn't go on this flight tonight.
Well, when she was making Blue, she even sort of dropped out of the music industry for a while before that record was made. She's a famous woman. She had relationships with famous men. She was constantly being framed within these relationships, an incredibly condescending viewpoint of a great artist. So what was the context of Blue being made and being as personal a record as it was? Was it because of the environment that was sort of being shaped around her, the sort of the narrative that she was being forced into as sort of a the lone female artist maybe that was getting that sort of recognition among a male-dominated industry?
Yeah, I think there's always a sense of Joni removing herself from the context she was in, the story that the press was telling about her, but it also is the moment after she leaves Graham Nash. And I talk about that in the piece too, that that seemed like a really kind of pivotal turning point for her, turning away from what could have been perhaps a stable and comfortable marriage and just fleeing and traveling and living a life of freedom, and also kind of questioning what she was leaving behind by choosing that freedom over Graham.
Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I made my baby cry.
You're a lot younger than me and Greg, and I wasn't even there when Joni was making her music. I wasn't quite conscious yet. You're a younger woman. How did you become exposed to Joni Mitchell, and what sort of an impact at what point in your life did the music have?
There's something really matrilineal about the way people get into Joni Mitchell, and that a lot of time it is literally through their mothers. And back in the days of like burning CDs onto your computer, I one day just was like, oh, I got to see what Joni Mitchell's all about. And I remember sort of doing it. I took it sneakily from my mom's collection and like put it back so she didn't know that I was like of the age to kind of understand what Joni Mitchell was coming from emotionally. There's usually kind of the older brother figure passing mm-hmm. down the cool records. And it's not a very cool story to say, well, I like Joni Mitchell because my mom exposed me to her. Under the surface of the canon that we usually talk about of men defining and passing, you know, what is the great music onto men, there's something kind of subterranean about the way that her music passes from generation to generation.
I love that.
I don't want you to put you in a position of speaking for all young women today, Lindsay, but I am. So you're going to have to be that spokesman for 2 minutes anyway. Do you think this kind of record, a record that was made, you know, in the early 70s, having an impact on a generation that was born well after, you know, Joni Mitchell's heyday, can still listen to this record and say, you know, I relate to it? I mean, or does it feel like a historical document rather than a living, breathing thing that speaks to young women today?
I think the record itself feels like a living, breathing thing that people of any gender can relate to, and young people, because this sort of feels like a farewell to the 20s record. And that's, you know, always kind of a theme in pop culture that's recurring throughout whatever generation is in the 20-something slot at the time. But I think that I wrote about this a bit, that I think Joni is so uncompromising and kind of prickly in some ways that she's hard to reduce into like a gif or a sort of internet icon in the way that, like, I wrote something about Stevie Nicks last year too. And I think she's someone who the image of Stevie Nicks has translated a lot more seamlessly onto like internet culture, youth culture, for whatever reason. But I think there's sort of the image, and then that is the gateway to the actual music. So I think both of those artists, the music has aged really well. I think Joni, though harder to kind of package and commodify in that way, once the music reaches you, there's something about it that feels timeless and feels raw and current, no matter what time and what generation you're talking about.
What would you say to the Cardi B fan, the Grimes fan, the Janelle Monáe fan, you know, the precocious, adventurous 18-year-old music lover, to say, all right, that's a great playlist you got there. Now you got to listen to Blue.
Words fail to describe, like, you kind of just have to sneak that on the playlist.
Put it in the Spotify playlist, yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of those artists, too, would say that they were influenced by her. And maybe that's a place to start with people that are unfamiliar with her. Like, there's just, you know, I talk in the piece about her connection with Prince and how Prince, as a teen, would go to these Joni Mitchell concerts and actually wrote her fan mail, like, in the Prince syntax with the four mm-hmm. number and stuff. And
U, letter U, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, just the influence she had on other artists who then influence other people. It's all this web of influence that kind of goes back to her through a lot of forward-thinking female artists.
Lindsay, what about, you mentioned Prince as being one of the artists who was heavily influenced by Joni. What are some other artists that you've come across in recent years that people may not be aware of that sort of mention Joni Mitchell as an influence on the way they make music?
I think a modern analog to her might be Fiona Apple. Mm-hmm. I think she has spoken about her influence, but just in the vividness of the lyricism and the kind of uncompromising way she has conducted her public life and kind of just plowed through whatever people had to say about her and kept making albums that went deeper and deeper into herself.
What I need is a good defense, 'cause I'm feeling like a criminal.
I think she's maybe one of the closest artists, but she also is not as prolific as Joni was. It's fascinating to look at that period in the late 60s through the mid 70s of just both how much she was fighting against every system that she came across, but was making so much music and putting out a brilliant record pretty much every year.
Mm-hmm.
I think Lauryn Hill, there's a comparison to be made there. But also someone who has not put out a lot of music, has kind of, I think part of the kind of quote-unquote female genius persona is it's really difficult to get things through the system and to get to make the necessary compromises to even release a record that you're proud of. So I do, now that I'm thinking of it, just the women that you could compare her to today aren't maybe having as easy a time with their record labels or
with the public perception. Yeah, I mean, you know, Fiona and Lauryn Hill, I mean, both paid significant price for their, mm-hmm. you know, were criticized in public in disturbing ways, you know, in a way that Joni never put up with.
There's just a lot more scrutiny now, a lot more lenses to scrutinize women through, just on the internet and with the way that the news cycle kind of works. I do think it might be harder in some ways to be a woman like Joni today. But I think there's just, I'm hoping that the floodgates are starting to, at least if not open, weaken in some way, because I do think there's just a much larger volume of female artists out there. They're more visible. You have to kind of dig around to find analogs in more modern context for her.
I think that's well said. That's a good point. All right, let me play a devil's advocate question, Lindsay.
Please.
The headline of your piece, you know, Fear of a Female Genius. You know, the problem when we have something like the NPR list of greatest albums ever made by women last year, right? You know, why aren't they just the greatest albums ever made, right? Why are they albums by women? Why is she a female? I mean, obviously her art is very much from a female perspective. But are we limiting her by saying a female genius as opposed to Neil Young genius, Bob Dylan genius, Leonard Cohen genius, just genius?
I think eventually, hopefully, we'll get there. I don't think we're there yet in the culture. You know, she was number one on the NPR women's list, but I think in the Rolling Stone greatest albums of all time, I think Blue was like number 30, and that was the first one by a woman. A reason that she's really fascinating to me is, and just to look at her whole story, is that she showed both the limitations on women at the time and also the way that they were able to be transcended. So I think that focusing on, you know, I talk in the piece about her pregnancy and the adoption and just the way that did kind of weigh on her throughout her life. That's, and the way that was always kind of something that was going to tether her to reality more than it did the men who kind of behaved like geniuses around that. They could leave their families a lot more freely than a woman was able to at that time. So I think looking at her in that context, what does it mean to be a female genius? Are there inherent compromises in that that make it different from a male one? And I think that just with maybe someday we'll get there where there's not, but I think just in the culture, we are unfortunately not there yet. There are not enough Jonies.
We've been talking to Lindsay Zolads from The Ringer about Joni Mitchell. Thanks for coming on the show, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, Jim and I are going to share some tracks that we think are important to highlight from that album. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And this week we're doing a classic album dissection of Joni Mitchell's Blue, which came out in 1971 and is arguably Mitchell's biggest success. We're going to share some of our favorite tracks now and why we think it is a classic album. Greg, you first.
Jim, I want to highlight the track California, which some people think of as one of the more optimistic songs on the record.
Yeah.
And it is a song about home, or at least her adopted home in California. Obviously, she was born in Canada. This was written as part of her European hiatus. She basically dropped out of the music industry for a number of months after her first three albums came out and made her a star. She just wanted to get away from everything, including California. She went to Europe and lived like a hippie for a while. But she got homesick. She decided, you know, even though I'm very disillusioned with California, I'm wearing out on this European lifestyle. I want to get back home. The whole idea of coming home was a hopeful sentiment. But there's also a key question at the heart of this song. It's a plaintive question that I think is the key to the album. That line, "Will you take me as I am?" She's speaking to California. She's speaking to America. She's speaking to her fan base. She's speaking to the men in her life. She is talking about, you know, I'm this woman who is independent, is doing my thing on my terms. Will you accept that? Because if you can't, I don't want any part of you. And that really is kind of the impetus of the Blue album. It's an emancipatory album in many ways with that question at the heart of it. And at the same time, the feeling of longing expressed so beautifully later in the song by a little subtle touch of pedal steel guitar from Sneaky Pete Kleino of the Flying Burrito Brothers. The way that pedal steel sort of wafts through the atmosphere created by Joni's voice and her Appalachian dulcimer. I think it's a beautiful song, but with many, many layers, and it is a great example of the multi-layered songwriting that is the key to this album. Very simple arrangements with many, many textures and feelings coursing through them. California from Joni Mitchell's Blue.
Sitting in a park in Paris, France, reading the news and it sure looks bad. They won't give peace a chance. That was just a dream some of us had. Still a lot of lands to see, but I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here. All the California, California, coming home. I'm gonna see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset peak. California, I'm coming home. I met a redneck on a Grecian Isle who did the goat dance very well. He gave me back my smile, but he kept my camera to sell. Oh, the rogue, the red, red rogue. He cooked good omelets and stews, and I might have stayed on with him there, but my heart cried out for you. California. Oh.
That is California, what I think is one of the key tracks from Joni Mitchell's Blue. Jim, what have you got?
Greg, we have to play Little Green. You know, we were talking about this daughter that Joni Mitchell had when she was a struggling college student and folk singer, had to give up for adoption. You know, that's in the mid-60s. It wasn't until the mid-90s when that part of her life was exposed by a tabloid. And she subsequently, a few years later, started a relationship with that young woman, her daughter, Kilauren Gibb. I think one of the sins that listeners, male and female, but in particular the male rock critic establishment, lays upon Blue is reading it as strict autobiography at all times. The reason I mention this, this is obviously a song written about her daughter, Little Green, but nobody knew about that for a good 25 years.
Yeah.
And now that's all anybody talks about in the context of this song. But if we look at the song, one of those classic weird Joni Mitchell guitar tunings, of her own, songs in open G, if we look at the lyrics, it's about longing in general. It could be first heard as longing for the seasons to change away from the cold and into the spring. It could be more specifically, I think, longing for any parent, in particular a father. All right, I'm a father of a daughter. So are you. Yeah. You've got two. About a daughter, both being an obsessive love, but also someday she's going to leave you.
Yeah.
And that's going to leave a hole. You were talking about how much longing and sadness and emancipation runs throughout Blue. It's not just in the romantic sense. It's also about in the sense of childhood. And then I think it's just a great song about hoping for something better, period. You don't need to know everything that happened to Joni. It's part of the context, but this is an immortal song because it stands without any of that. Little Green by Joni Mitchell on Sound Opinions.
Born with the moon in Cancer, choose her a name she will answer to. Call her green, and the winters cannot fade her. Call her green for the children who've made her little green. Be a gypsy dancer. He went to California. He everything's warmer there. So you write him a letter and say her eyes are blue. He sends you a poem and she's lost to you. Little green, he's a non-conformer, just a little.
Joni Mitchell, Little Green on Sound Opinions. Greg, another song to highlight from Blue.
I like your choice of Little Green, Jim, because I think it illustrates, the strength of Joni's songwriting, because you wouldn't have known it was about her daughter unless you had inside information. It
right.
could have been about many, many situations. At the same time, take drawings very specifically on the pain in her private life to create a song that has universal significance. And I think many of the songs on Blue have that regard. So to call it a confessional album, I think completely misreads what it's about. A great example of that is the song River. It's amazing how this song has become a Christmas standard, a holiday standard. You can hear it at Starbucks playing on the, when you go in for a coffee starting like about mid-November. It's just one of those things that's kind of like wallpaper now for the holidays. And it is an incredibly sad song. It's almost like a eulogy. Here's the Canadian girl singing about skating away on a river while she's in California, a place that at the time she does not really love and is kind of getting disgusted by. The key line for me, I wish I had a river so long, I would teach my feet to fly. And the way her voice just sort of flies off on that last syllable is just so beautiful and heartbreaking. And then lands on, I made my baby cry. This whole notion of, I've just gone through this relationship that ended terribly. I miss my home of origin. I miss my childhood. Thinking about all these things coursing through the song and doing it beautifully with the framing device of Jingle Bells. I think that's why people think, oh, it's a holiday song. But it's played so sadly and mournfully. And she starts off singing, you know, with a kind of a plaintive tone to those chords. And then at the end, it's devastatingly slow. It's almost like a eulogy. So it's a beautiful and yet heartbreaking song that I think encapsulates the multitude of emotions that are coursing through the Blue Album. Here's River from Joni Mitchell on Sound Opinions.
It's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here. It stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long, I would teach my feet to fly.
River from Joni Mitchell. You've got one more great blue track for us, Jim.
A Case of You, Greg. The Mitchell obsessives, who I think often are obsessing and not listening, debate. Is this song about her romantic split from Graham Nash, or is it about Leonard Cohen? I don't care. That's Joni's life. That's not her art. What is brilliant about this art is that we've all had a case of someone that is both good for us and bad for us. Everybody, you know, obligatory rock critic quote, I'm a lonely painter, I live in a box of paints, okay? But to me, the lines before that, you know, you are in my blood like holy wine. You taste so bitter and so sweet. I could drink a case of you and I'd still be on my feet. That's everything I love about Joni Mitchell. Number one, she's tough as nails. You know what I mean? Yeah. You are not going to drink me under the table. I'll kill you first, right? Number two, the play on a case of you, like a bad case of the flu. Mm. But also, I'll devour a case of you. I can't get enough. Mm. I love you, but I'm also broken by this relationship as we end it. All of these feelings are encompassed. And, you know, a lot of times we talk about artists who cover something. I think it's a testament when a wide array of incredible talents come to the same song for inspiration and make it their own. Tori Amos, Prince, Diana Krall, Katie Lang, all of them have done versions of A Case of You. I think that they are all hearing something in it different and bringing something of their own. And, you know, so is everyone who really listens to and loves Blue. Mm-hmm. A Case of You by Joni Mitchell on Sound Opinions.
Just before our love got lost, you said, I am as constant as a northern star. And I said, constantly in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar. Back of a cartoon coaster in the blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada. Oh, Canada, with your face sketched on it twice. I would still be on my feet.
A Case of You by Joni Mitchell, wrapping up our classic album dissection of her 1971 album, Blue. Now we want to hear from you. Do you have any opinions on Blue or Joni Mitchell or anything in the music world? Call 888-859-1800 and leave us a message. Greg, what do we got on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have a great conversation and performance lined up from Margot Price.
As always, Sound Opinions was produced by Brendan Banizak, Alex Claiborne, and Ayanna Contreras.
Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
Hi, Jim and Greg. It's Jeremy Shatton from New York City. And great episode on Giving the Drummer Some, something I truly believe in. I thought I would just mention that John Bonham was a sampler himself, in a sense, because the intro to rock and roll, that wonderful hi-hat snare thing that he does, was actually a sample itself, in a way, from Charles Connor, who invented that beat for Little Richard on Keep a Knockin'. Keep a knockin', but they can't come in. It blew my mind when I put on the second Little Richard album and heard that song. As far as favorite drum beats go, I would have to mention I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea by Elvis Costello and the Attractions. Pete Thomas, always a great drummer. Drumming on that song is just astonishing. The way he comes in with such fierce, almost second-line funk on that thing, and then the spidery guitar comes in, and it's off to the races. It's just one of Elvis's greatest songs. So anyway, keep up the great work, and I will talk to you guys later. Ciao.
Hi, Jim and Greg. My name is Corinne, and I'm calling from Utica, New York. I just listened to your Anxious Anthems episode, and I wanted to call in and suggest a song that I think is just the absolute best at capturing tension and anxiety, and that's The National Anthem by Radiohead. It's probably my favorite Radiohead song of all time. It's just such a weird, cacophonous thing until you feel like you're just going to go nuts listening to it. And it never really resolves. It just maintains that anxiety the whole time. It's so good. Anyway, I love the show. Okay, thanks very much.
Hi, this is Peter Forsyth. I'm just enjoying your latest Anxious Anthems episode. And there's a song I think you might have missed that I think would be a fun addition if you revisit this. This is from the hip-hop genre, which is definitely one of my favorite areas of music, but I think doesn't really tend to access that particular range of emotions all that often, but the song, which is really one of my favorites, is called The Rooster, and it's from the Speaker Box Love Below album by Outkast. I woke up very upset. I throw the covers back and peep out through the draperies. My daughter, my baby mama all escaping me. Like a when the wind, she was my friend. Like Princess died before she died, therefore we tried and tried again. But in the end, you pay attention to the pluses, but the minuses behind it make it seem like you can't win. It's a pretty rollicking romp through the singer's psyche. Thanks very much.
Hey, this is Judy Thomas from Stone Mountain, Georgia. I was just listening to Sound Opinion on WABE here in Atlanta, and you had a great episode about tension and pressure and songs that are about anxiety. You totally skipped over one that is absolutely one that just, oh golly, it's so full of anxiety, and the tension builds in the song is perfect, and it's by Billy Joel, Pressure. You have to learn to pace yourself, Pressure. So good. Thanks so much. Bye.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.